And here we have another glorious day to share together and to enjoy together and to grow together. I'm so delighted that an old friend and a client of mine, I told you some about my literary agency last night, a client of mine, Gail Harris, can only be with us today, but I'm so glad that she's able to come. It's the first time she's ever seen me in my native habitat. So that's kind of fun. I was walking between my room and the dining hall this morning, and I felt an old ache start up in my knee. And it's a result of a baseball injury when I was in college. And at one time when I was at a CFO camp with Marcia Brown, how many of you remember Marcia Brown?
Oh, yes.
Almost everybody. She was here every year for years and years and years. She and her husband were among the very earliest of the CFO leaders, and she was a great woman of prayer. And I was walking down towards the lake, and she was walking with me, and I started to limp a little bit. And she said, "What's the matter with your knee?" And I said, "Well, it's an old injury, and the doctor said that some arthritis has set in." And she looked at me, and she said, "And how old are you?" I think I was like 28 at the time. And she said, "Well, would you mind if we sat down, and I laid hands on your knee and prayed for you?" And I said, "Sure." You know. So we did, and she laid hands on my knee, and she closed her eyes, and she prayed, "Arthritis, dear God, don't be ridiculous." You can add that to your list of prayers if you like. To expand a little bit on the metaphor of CFO as a banquet, what I shared about the choir that excels not because everybody sings the same part, but that we each sing our hearts out in our own voice. Please think of what you hear from the leaders this week and the other campers this week as a wonderful, heavily laden banquet table. And you are the honored guest. You are here by special invitation. You are expected and wanted and cherished. All creation rejoices that you are here, that we are here together sharing this feast. There will be many different dishes, many different ideas arrayed before us at this banquet, some familiar, some may be new to you. It's good to remember that it's just fine to set aside anything that doesn't agree with you and anything that is not for you. I've discovered a spiritual principle that's very important to me that I call leave it. Leave it. And I learned this particular principle from a wonderful big black Labrador retriever, a dog named Murphy. Leave it helps me to stay conscious in so many situations, including discerning God's gifts from the distractions that sometimes get around those gifts. And I share it with you as a tool that you might also find valuable. In April of 1995, I was visiting Ojai, California, working with several of my new clients in my new literary agency on their book projects. The phone rang, and it was Bob calling from home in Washington, and saying urgently, "Turn on the television. There's been a terrible explosion in Oklahoma City." So we turned on the TV and we watched, horrified, as the events of the bombing of the Murrah Federal Building unfolded in front of us. As we watched, we saw a tiny little woman in a navy blue jumpsuit precariously crisscrossing parts of the collapsed structure with her big black lab, searching that rubble for any people who might have been trapped and survived the blast. A friend who was watching with me, Malkia, said, "That's Wilma and her dog." Wilma and Murphy lived in Ojai. They were a highly trained disaster search team and had been deployed to Oklahoma City to search for survivors in that collapsed building. A week later, Wilma and Murphy were back home in Ojai. Wilma could hardly talk about her experience through her tears. Tears of anger, tears of rage and frustration and grief. This was the first time that disaster search teams had been deployed from all over the country for a human-caused disaster. Wilma was devastated by what she had seen and felt and experienced, and because she knew that if more teams had been available and on site, more lives might have been saved. These wonderful disaster search dogs have to become completely focused on their work, completely one-pointed. That, to me, is a powerful analogy for the kind of focus required of us for the spiritual journey. Seek first the kingdom. Yearn first for the kingdom. It's about what comes first, about one-pointedness. If the dogs are looking for a live human being trapped under a collapsed building, they cannot be distracted by the sight of frantic, panicking human beings running wildly in all directions around them. They can't be diverted by the many odors that abound in a disaster. They must learn the difference between the scent of a live human being who could be rescued and to ignore the scent of a deceased human being. And they must be perfectly trained to alert their handler only when they scent out a living human being who can be helped. Wilma very much needed to bring something positive into the world from her devastating experience in Oklahoma City. More than anything else, she saw the need for highly trained search dogs and handler teams to be on call and available in all cities around our country in time of disaster. So she and I worked together to establish a foundation to develop more effective disaster search methods and to bring dogs and handlers to FEMA certification, Federal Emergency Management Agency certification. The National Disaster Search Dog Foundation rescues dogs from shelters. I love this. Dogs that have exceptionally high play drive and prey drive, so intense are they that they couldn't settle down enough to be ordinary pets for a family. And that's why they ended up in shelters. These rescued dogs have exactly the instincts and characteristics needed for disaster search. The foundation provides professional training for these dogs and for the handlers, who are most often first responders like Jay, firefighters, paramedics, that make up our urban search and rescue teams. During one of the early training days of the foundation, I saw a really remarkable example of this kind of one-pointedness. You who know Labradors, have any of you ever had labs? Yeah. You who know Labradors know that their every instinct is to catch prey and to bring it back to their person, right? While Murphy was practicing direction control, that's where the handler sends the dog out 100 yards away with a hand signal and then asks the dog to move 100 yards this way by pointing and so forth, learning to follow the hand signal directions. Suddenly, a rabbit burst from a bush not 3 feet from where Murphy was working. As the rabbit zoomed by the dog's nose, she took one leap after it, delighted to catch that thing and to bring it to Murphy, to bring it to Wilma. But Wilma shouted, "Murphy, leave it." That's all it took. That dog skidded to a stop, her rump went down, and she sat there, "What next, Mom? What next?" I could not believe what I'd just seen. This dog was so focused on her job, so one-pointed, that nothing, not even a delicious rabbit zooming in front of her nose, could distract her from her purpose. Oh, how I want to be like that in my spiritual journey. So focused that nothing can distract me or divert me. I will probably come back to the principle of leave it later in the week, because it applies to so many things that would distract and divert us from seeking first the kingdom. But leave it can also apply to anything that you hear this week that is not for you. Leave it. You don't have to chase it. You don't have to catch it. You don't have to shake it to death. Just leave it. Be one-pointed at this banquet. Be open to receive what you recognize as God's special, unique gifts prepared just for you. So, as we come together in this particular configuration of the body of Christ, I wonder, What prompted each of us to come to camp this week? It's been my experience that each of us has come to learn, and sometimes that learning is very, very specific to a huge need in our lives right now. And it's equally my experience that each one of us has something to share, something to enrich those who are drawn to you and that you are drawn to this week, something that may be transformational and life-giving to someone else at this camp. Watch for these moments of giving and receiving throughout the day, at meals, at prayer groups, at creatives, at rhythms. Sometimes we've been drawn to camp because we need a time apart, a time to heal, a time to listen to God more deeply than we ever have before. One person shared with me at the start of another camp, "God has betrayed me." That wrenched my heart. God has betrayed me. I have started divorce proceedings from God. Even with the tremendous turmoil that she found herself in, she decided to come to camp and listen, to really listen to God in prayer and see if there were any alternative open to her to divorcing God, whom she perceived as betraying her when she developed a terminal illness. A minister friend of mine found himself torn, not knowing if he was any longer called to ministry. He was finding it harder and harder to pastor a church that was dwindling and that hardly seemed relevant anymore anyhow. He came seeking a resolution, guidance to either double down and work harder at his church or to leave and explore new lands. One of our high school campers at Lassen last month was absolutely bubbling when she arrived at camp, so delighted to be connecting with her friends from camp's past, and could hardly wait for the singing to start. That was the most important thing to her. For her, it was sharing the joy that brings her back. If we took a poll amongst us right now and asked, "Why did you come to camp this week?" I'll bet we'd hear some pretty consistent answers, things that are true for most of us. And each of us also brings our unique needs and yearnings this week. Let's take a moment. Close your eyes if that helps you to focus and block out distractions. And ask yourself, why did I come to camp this year? What do I need to receive from God this week? I'll bet that underneath that first response is an even deeper response. So dig deeper and ask again, why did I come to camp this year? What do I need from God this week? If we look deeply enough, I'll bet the deepest response is the same for many of us. Underneath the outer joys of our lives or the crises that propelled us to come to camp, there's that deeper call. We're here because our souls are hungry for more. We know deep in the deepest core of our beings that the yearning for oneness with God is the most important thing in our quest on earth. That's what we're here for. And it keeps calling to us, it keeps nudging us until we attend to it. I told you last night that when I was in high school, a A friend from church who had been deeply influenced by Glenn Clark and the Camps Farthest Out gave me a copy of a little booklet called The Divine Plan. maybe we could have people at the door handed out as people walk out the door to rhythm. So that, oh, yep, thank you. You're ahead of me as usual, Dana. The wisdom in this brief writing hit me with the force of revelation. I mean, it knocked my socks off. It completely cracked open my worldview, and it planted deep in me a dream that there is indeed more than what we see happening, what we perceive to be happening, that there is a way to deeper understand Jesus' prayer that the kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven, and that by practicing the principles, by acting on the principles that I saw in the divine plan, I might bring myself more in harmony with what I believe that God is doing in us and through us and beyond us to bring the kingdom of heaven on earth. So I've lived daily with that wisdom that I found in the divine plan for more than 50 years. It comes to my awareness every single time a new person is woven into my life experience. And that includes you here this week. Because it has guided my spiritual formation for nearly as long as I can remember, and since it's shaped my spiritual growth so strongly, I'm looking forward to drinking deeply again from the divine plan with you this week. Here's passage number one. Wait a second. Thomas Merton, again, the great Trappist monk and theologian and mystic, once said something I love about spiritual growth. He said, if the you of 5 years ago does not consider the you of today a heretic, then you're not growing spiritually. Let me say that again. If the you of 5 years ago doesn't consider the you of today a heretic, you are not growing spiritually. And I think that's true for me. I know it is. I'm not suggesting that anything in the divine plan, nor any of the spiritual principles that have shaped my life and that I'll be sharing with you, is the final word, or that they're the only way, or anything approaching absolute truth. But rather, I offer them to you as I have experienced them, as an opportunity for learning. I'm farther along in my understanding of God's divine plan than I was 5 years ago, certainly farther along than last time I shared with you almost 40 years ago. And I expect to be, I hope to be, farther along in another 5 years, as Merton suggests. Like in a science laboratory at school, we were given a theory or a formula or a principle and told to experiment with it. If the divine plan calls to your heart, work with it, or better yet, play with it. Try it out. Explore it. Try its principles. See if it works. See what happens in your life if you work with it. To this day, there are very few things in my spiritual life and understanding that I consider to be absolute or final truths. Truth reveals itself as we act on the highest that we know in the moment. And acting on it either confirms our current understanding or it propels us beyond to deeper understanding and deeper truth from the divine plan. I believe that God has a divine plan for me. I believe that this plan is wrapped in the folds of my being. Even as the oak is wrapped in the acorn, and the rose is wrapped in the bud. I believe that this plan is permanent, indestructible, and perfect, free from all that is essentially bad. Whatever comes into my life that is negative is not a part of this God-created plan, but a distortion caused by my failure to harmonize myself with the plan as God has made it. I believe that this plan is divine, and when I relax myself completely to it, it will manifest completely and perfectly through me. I can always tell when I'm relaxed to the divine plan by the inner peace that comes to me. This inner peace brings a joyous, creative urge that leads me into activities that unfold the plan, or it brings a patience and a stillness that allow others to unfold the plan to me. I've shared this notion of the divine plan in almost every camp I've been to around the world and over the years. If someone new comes into my life, it's almost a reaction that I immediately give them a copy of the divine plan and share this. And especially if I sense that delicious potential that they might become a spiritual playmate or soul companion. For most, it had the same influence for good as it has had for me. For a few, it's become the kind of generative touchstone and springboard to growth that it always has been for me. A few were indifferent, didn't speak much to them, and that was fine. We're all at different places along the path, and to some it isn't necessarily nurturing, and what touches us at one stage of our growth might not at another. Shortly after my husband Bob died last year, I remembered that we had purchased tickets for an orchestra concert to be held 3 weeks after he died. Bob and I both loved classical music, particularly Mozart, and there were a few pieces at this concert that we especially wanted to hear. My grieving was still very, very raw, and I never knew when it might well up, reducing me to sobs at the most inappropriate moments, and it still happens from time to time. I really hesitated to go to this concert at a favorite place to hear favorite music, something we love to do together, because I knew it would be so hard to do without him. I hated not having him there to enjoy it. But one of the greatest learnings I've had about the healing of grief is this: never choose to avoid the hard thing. Never choose to avoid the hard thing. Embrace it. Embrace the hard choice. Run headlong into it. Give yourself to the challenges that are difficult. If I don't do this next thing that's hard, because it's painful, because it reminds me so much of what I've lost, then the next thing that looks like it's going to be hard will be easier to sidestep. And then the next, and the next. And I found that I was not willing to sit out the last chapters of my life because some things are hard to do. I did go to that concert by myself. It required a few deep breaths and some blinking back of tears to park the car and to go into the auditorium. The first half of the concert contained familiar and beloved pieces, beautifully performed. At the intermission, I felt totally at loose ends, in the midst of a standoff with the grief. Not knowing what else to do with myself, I walked over to the side wall and I began studying the portraits of the Talawa people that lined the auditorium. The concert hall is a part of the Talawa Indian Nation headquarters. The Talawa people once inhabited the California coastal area, clear from the Klamath River to the south, north into Oregon. As I was admiring the portraits and the glimpse of a time gone by, and taking some deep breaths and swallowing hard, a woman came up to me and said, "Hi, I'm Martha." Reminded me of the dog. She told me she was with a group of women from her church, from the town north of us into Oregon, who had spontaneously decided to come to the concert after church. We chatted briefly, and I realized that we were in deep waters almost immediately, comparing notes on who we were reading, whose thoughts on spiritual growth challenged us. I didn't know who she was, but there was that spark of recognition. Sort of that feeling of having found someone that you'd known forever but lost, and all of a sudden here they are again. While having a perfectly wonderful talk about going farthest out spiritually, to my total astonishment, I found myself welling up with tears and sobs and telling her about Bob, blurting out the story of our last days together and how much I missed him. I mean, who does that to somebody you just met standing in a very public place? I was pretty sure she thought she'd run into a nut. Following intermission, Martha returned to her seat with her friends. And after the final encore, people made their way towards the door. She materialized at my elbow again, and she handed me a business card from her church. I realized that card was one of the neatest ideas that I've ever seen for advertising a church. On one side was all the contact information about the church. On the other side was, "Please join me for," with a blank to fill in. Church members shared these cards with people they met in the community to invite new people to services or classes or a potluck or a music program. Martha filled in her phone number and name and said, "Next time you come to Brookings, give me a call and let's go get coffee." I thought to myself, yeah, right. I just don't do that sort of thing. You see, I was still running on these 15 years of conditioning, of the conditioning of 24/7 nursing home level care, hands-on, where for years it took serious and meticulous planning and arranging of safety nets, even to manage a quick trip to the grocery store or to the post office, much less drive myself to Oregon for a cup of coffee. But the following days, I kept feeling that spark of recognition. Someone who was reading the same progressive Christian writers that I was, who had reached some of the same limits that I had, and who was reaching out for the same openness. And the delicious thought of having a conversation about broader issues than preventing bed sores and adjusting medications and arranging physical therapy, it just became too interesting to resist. So, of course, the first thing I did was to zap Martha a copy of The Divine Plan. We had talked enough about the spiritual quest, even in that brief meeting at the concert, that I was sure she'd get it and be as inspired by it as I would have always been. And it's also a shorthand way of introducing what's really important and most meaningful to me in the spiritual quest. Her response? A sort of intense and very direct, "Well, I don't believe this at all." I don't remember her exact words, but she definitely does not believe that God is some sort of a puppet master in the sky pulling strings and forcing people to experience this or meet that person or do this thing. She felt that the divine plan was another way of talking about predestination, a doctrinal notion that we have no choices, no free will. And she just wasn't having any of it. I was, as our English friends say, totally gobsmacked. In all these years, I'd never run into anyone who didn't connect with this little booklet on at least some level. And you know, I can't begin to tell you what a great gift this discontinuity was, this challenge to my awareness. It was a gift because it made me pull back and reconsider my lifelong assumptions about the nature of our reality, about our experience on this planet, about the nature of God. How does God really work in our lives to grow us into God's likeness? My first reaction, of course, was to try and convince Martha that I certainly do not believe in predestination either. I don't believe in that sort of divine plan either. To me, Glenn's vision here is not a blueprint, not a static blueprint for a house which must be inevitably and invariably followed, nail by nail and brick by brick, in order to create a house that must inevitably turn out to be two stories high with yellow paint and green trim. The divine plan that I understand is much, much more living and organic and fluid than this. To me, it's not a blueprint, but maybe more like our genetic potential, our unique individual genetic potential. A genome is an organism's complete set of DNA, including all of its genes. Each genome contains all of the information needed to build and maintain that organism, whether that organism is a human being, or a starfish, or a big black lab, or an oak tree wrapped in the acorn, or the rose wrapped in the bud. In humans, a copy of the entire genome, more than 3 billion DNA base pairs, is contained in every single one of our cells. every single one of our cells that has a nucleus. I can barely wrap my mind around that. With the possible exception of identical siblings, no one else in human history has come into this world with the exact set of genetic possibilities that you have, that I have. And no one else will ever be born on this planet who has your genetic potentials. Our genetic potential has infinite possibilities for expression, and yet it limits us as well. Our genes can allow us to be most any sort of human being, tall or short, brown eyes or blue, potential for robust health or sickliness, the gifts of intellectual or athletic ability, the gifts of music or arts or languages. But whatever gifts or limitations our genes give us, the human genome creates a human being and nothing else. We are limited to expressing as a human being, not a lion or a frog or a whale or a yellow house. Genes create infinite potentials within what we call human. But our genes limit us to a plan that is uniquely human in its expression. The divine plan can be thought of, I believe, as an analogy to our genetic plan, a parable maybe of our genetic plan. Our divine plan is as unique to each one of us as our unique genetic potential is, as our unique genome, our unique set of potentials, enables us to grow and become the best expression of the human species that we're able to become. In the same way, our unique divine plan enables us to grow into the fullness of our unique spiritual potential. God's plan for each of us contains the means for the unfolding and the flowering of our full potential as sons and daughters of the living God, and of our minds into the mind of Christ. Our divine plan functions as our genes function. The divine plan can be thought of as the means to the fulfillment of the prayer that Jesus prayed for us, for you and for me, that they may all be one. Even as you, Father, are in me, and I am in you, that they may be perfectly one. I am asking that they may live in us, that they may be one as we are one, I in them and you in me, that they may grow complete into one, so that the world may see that you love them exactly as you love me. The divine plan doesn't, I don't think, so much orchestrate that a specific person is to come into our lives at a specific moment for a specific purpose. Like, I don't think the unique divine plan specified that Martha had to introduce herself to me at the concert that day in order for her unique divine plan or for mine to unfold. And if she hadn't, all that I've learned from her and all that she's learned from me, I don't think it would have been lost. I think it works more like this. There are particular learnings that I need to attain, that you need to attain, to fully express my spiritual potential if I am to become a mature, fully functioning daughter of God, expression of God in this world. If Martha hadn't appeared that Sunday, I believe that what I needed to learn from her would have come in another way, perhaps another someone or several someones, maybe at another time or place. But just as in our genetic plan, if all goes according to the pattern, we're infants, then children, then adolescents, and then we're adults, no matter which individuals or events come into our lives. And if all goes according to our potentials, we end up fully formed human beings. And in the same way our unique divine plan draws to us, God grows within us whatever we need for the fulfillment of our unique divine plan. By the way, Martha had never heard of CFO either. She came to Lassen Camp last month, some of you knew her there, and she found an amazing next step in spiritual growth. And I will always be grateful to her for challenging me to dig deeper for ways to talk about the divine plan that might make it more accessible to some of you who may have had some of the same questions. So maybe it isn't that any particular event must happen in order for the plan to unfold. I suspect it's more like the insight from Scripture that all things work together for good. All things work together for good, for the glory of God. All things work together to open the potentials for our highest growth into awareness of our oneness with God and our unique contribution to the unfolding of the kingdom of heaven on earth. And we can trust and welcome and embrace each next person and each next event as the catalyst for that growth and as a wonderful gift from God. Over all these years of living with the divine plan, of attempting to live the divine plan, to embody it, there's only been one sentence that I've taken issue with in what Glenn wrote, and it's in the passage that we're looking at this morning. I so wish it were possible to sit down with him and talk to him about it. It's this sentence: whatever comes into my life that is negative is not a part of this God-created plan, but a distortion caused by my failure to harmonize myself with the plan as God has made it. In one sense, the way Glenn has expressed this does ring true for me. Often the things that I judge to be bad or negative certainly don't seem to be part of God's plan. But there's another way of looking at those things that we judge to be negative, the things that we think are not part of God's plan for our lives. And I've come to think of them, in the word that I used earlier, I've come to think of them as discontinuities, as something that breaks up our comfortable continuity of thought and belief, as challenges to our awareness, as challenges to go beyond our current understanding. I'm going to be sharing more about the gift of discontinuity as the week goes on. I keep talking about the kingdom of God, kingdom living. What do I mean by that? I mean the realm of God, the realm of spirit in which we live and move and have our true being. I don't think very many of us any longer conceive of God as an old man in the sky with a long white beard, seated on a golden throne, presiding over a triple-decker universe with heaven as a celestial dwelling place above the earth and hellfire below, precariously sandwiching our fragile blue planet somewhere in the middle. These concepts were logical and helpful in earlier generations, but our understanding of the world and our place in the world has evolved. And sometimes our spiritual vocabulary has not kept up with our growing understanding. My best understanding at this moment is that God is love. God is love. And love is the ground of all being, the source from which all else springs, from the subatomic whirling particles to the vast galaxies that expand out through the cosmos, creating and quickening and sustaining that great generative and harmonizing principle that we call love. God is love, and the one who lives in love lives in God, and God lives in that one. Closer than our breathing, nearer than our hands and feet, above all, in all, expressing through us all. Another way of pointing to God that I've just recently been playing with is to describe God as not a being, a personality, a being outside of us, but perhaps as a living, interactive, generative process. We can think of God perhaps as a process. God is the process of love in action, in interaction with us, in interaction with all creation, interacting and wooing and drawing us to fullness, to the fullest expression of our potential. The most astonishing thing that I have learned in this spiritual journey is that we are invited, called, expected to live this love, to participate in this love, in this harmonizing, in this transformation for the healing of our world. One of the richest and most challenging times in our experience with CFO International was almost 3 months spent on the Indian subcontinent, planting the seeds of CFO, organizing and working with interdenominational prayer groups and introducing CFO to churches, and speaking at CFO camps and the first national training camps for CFO leaders in that region. Jay, I'm not telling the story that you want me to tell about this tonight, but I hope to before the week's over. We were scheduled to spend a week in Calcutta for a camp to meet with the CFO leaders. One of the Calcutta CFO leaders was also a volunteer in the Home for the Destitute and Dying, one of Mother Teresa's project in that city. He asked us if we would like to meet Mother Teresa while we were there. What do you suppose we said? Of course we would. So he checked in with the sisters. The only time that we could be in Calcutta was during Holy Week, the week before Easter, a time that Mother Teresa always observed in silence and prayer and meditation, seeing no visitors. Our friend persisted and spoke with Mother directly. When she learned that we were coming for CFO, she made an exception to her silent retreat, and she agreed to meet with us. When we were with her, she told us that it was because so many of the sisters and brothers in her order had participated in CFO camps around the world that she wanted to know what CFO was and she wanted to meet us. She said that so many people in her community found enrichment in the camps. I'll probably share more about our time with Mother Teresa as the week goes on. But today there's one thing that she said that has haunted me and challenged me and inspired me. And I yearn to practice this with you this week. Jesus challenged those who loved him to see him and serve him in other people. You remember Jesus described that in the end, it all comes down to service. It all comes down to meeting the needs that are around us. When I was hungry, you gave me food. When I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. And they wondered, like I wonder, like you wonder, when did we see Christ hungry and give food? When did we see Christ thirsty and give something to drink? And he said to them, "Inasmuch as you have done it unto one of the least of these your brothers, your sisters, you have done it for me. You have done it for me." When you have helped another, when you have served another, you have helped and served me. As we walked the streets of Calcutta, my heart was broken by the sheer human need around us. Lepers begging with open sores. Children living on the streets with no parents to care for them. People starving. People dying. When I asked Mother Teresa how she could bear to keep on with this work that she'd been called to, knowing that the human need before her was endless, she said, "Barbara, don't you see that the one I serve is Christ in his most distressing disguise?" She took quite literally the words of Jesus, "As you have done it unto one of the least of these, you have done it unto me." Spirit in Action, whose roots are in CFO, you'll hear more about that this week. And you can talk to Tanya, who's the administrator of Spirit in Action. A prime focus of Spirit in Action is providing grants, not loans, but grants, to people in deep poverty in Africa. Along with the grants comes business training and local support as they grow their businesses. As they become successful, they share the gift, using some of their income to help others to start their own small businesses. Where before, the person who received a grant might only have enough food to eat once every 2 or 3 days. As they build their business, they have enough food to eat every day, and then 3 times a day, and then focus on more nutritious food for their family. There's even enough money generated to keep their children in school, which is a huge thing. A few months ago, the Spirit in Action Board had its spring meeting in my home. We'd been learning about the challenges and achievements of our partners in Africa since the last board meeting. During a time of shared visioning and prayer, I put into words my yearning that we might more deeply understand what it is we are about in that work, that we could more and more deeply realize that it's about recognizing and serving Christ in those distressing disguises. And then I looked around at that group of loving people, and I realized more deeply than ever before that we are called to serve Christ not only in the distressing disguise, but also in Christ's most glorious disguises and all the disguises in between. In other words, we are called to recognize that whatever we do for each other, to each other, we do for Christ who dwells within each of us. And that, my friends, is why I believe God has called us to this place this week, that it might be for us a living laboratory to explore more deeply the love of God, to discover more deeply who we are, that we may love and serve each other in whatever disguise we've come, that we might learn what it is to live in the kingdom of heaven, the realm of love, here and now. Let's pray together. Great Creator, may we go on and on, deeper and deeper into your love, until we know we are fully one with you, even as you are now fully one with us. Amen.